and we cried out in pleasure together. Whenever we were not kissing or coupling or sleeping, Shalem and I traded stories. I told him of my father and my mother's, and described my brothers one by one. He was delighted by their names, and learned each one in the order of his birth, and knew which one came from the womb of which mother. I'm not sure my own father could have listed them so well. He told me of his tutor, a cripple with a wonderful voice, who taught him to sing and to read. Shalem told me of his mother's devotion and his five half-brothers, none of whom had learned the arts of Egypt. He told me of his trip to the priestess, who initiated him in the art of love in the name of heaven. I never saw her face, he said. The rites take place in the innermost chamber, where there is no light. It was like a dream locked inside a dream. He told me of three times he had slept with a slave girl, who giggled in his embrace and asked for payment afterward. But by the end of our second day together, our embraces outnumbered his experiences with other women. I have forgotten them all, he said. Then I will forgive you them all, I said. We made love again and again. We slept and awoke with our hands on each other. We kissed each other everywhere, and I learned the flavor of my lover's toes, the smell of his sex before and after coupling, the dampness of his neck. We were together as bride and groom for 3 days before I began to wonder why I had not been fetched to go and wash Ashnan's feet or rub her back. Shalem, too, forgot his obligatory evening meals with his father. But Raynefer took care that we should know nothing of the world, and that the world should give us peace. She sent choice foods at all hours of the day and night, and instructed the servants to fill Shalem's bath with fresh scented water whenever we slept. I had no worries for the future. Shalem said our lovemaking sealed our marriage. He teased me about the bride price he would bring to my father. Buckets of gold coins, camels laden with lapis and linen, a caravan of slaves, a herd of sheep so fine their wool never needed washing. You deserve a queen's ransom, he whispered, as we drifted back to our shared dreams. I will build you a tomb of surpassing beauty, Shalem said. The world will never forget the name of Dina, who judged my heart worthy. I wish I had been as bold with my words. Not that I was shy. Shalem knew of my delight in him, my gratitude for him, my lust for him. I gave him everything. I abandoned myself to him and in him. It was only that I could not find a voice for the flood of my happiness. While I lay in Shalem's first embrace, Levi was storming out of Hamor's palace, furious that he had not been given the audience with the king that he considered his due. My brother had been dispatched to see when I would be sent home, and had he been given a fine meal and a bed for the night, my life might have had a different telling. Later, I wondered what might have happened had Reuben or Judah come for me. Hamor was not eager to meet with that particular son of Jacob, the quarrelsome one who had accused him of swindling the family. Why should the king suffer through another round of accusations by some whining son of a shepherd? If it had been Reuben, Hamor would have welcomed him to dine and spend the night. Indeed, if it had been any of the others, even Joseph, he would have received a fine welcome. Hamor approved of Jacob nearly as much as his queen liked Jacob's wives. The king knew that my father tended his flocks with such skill that he had quickly become the richest shepherd in the valley. Jacob's wool was the softest, his wives skilled, and his sons loyal. He caused no feuds among neighbors. He had enriched the valley, and Hamor was eager for good relations with him. Marriages between their two houses were much to be desired, so Hamor was pleased when Raynefer whispered that his son favored Jacob's daughter. Indeed, as soon as the king heard that Shalem was lying with me, he began to count out a handsome bride price. When Hamor heard from the servants that the young couple were well matched, adoring, and busy producing his grandson, the news aroused him so much that he called Ashnan to his bed, a full week before her confinement was due to end. When Rainefer discovered them, she barely scolded her husband and the girl, so great was her joy at her son's match. On the fourth day of our happiness, Shalem arose from our bath, dressed, and told me he was going to speak to his father. It is time for Hamor to arrange for the bride price. He looked so handsome in his tunic and sandals that my eyes filled with tears again. No more weeping, not even for happiness, he said, and lifted me, still wet from the water, and kissed my nose and my mouth, and put me on the bed and said, Wait for me, beloved. Do not dress. Only lie here so I may think of you like this. I won't be long. I covered his face with kisses and told him to hurry back. I was asleep when he slipped beside me, smelling of the world beyond our bed for the first time in days. Hamor departed for Jacob's camp early the next morning, a laden wagon behind him. He did not bring a tent or servants for a night's stay. He did not expect to stay or to haggle. How could he have imagined any objection to his good news and generous gift? The news about Shalem and Jacob's daughter was widespread in the city, but unknown in Jacob's tents. When he heard that I had been taken as wife by the prince of the city, he said nothing and made no reply to Hamor's offer. He stood like a stone, staring at the man of whom his sons Levi and Simon had spoken with such venom. A man of his own years, it turned out, but richly dressed, smooth-spoken, and fat. The king waved at a cart laden with goods and trailing sheep and goats. He declared them kin, soon to share a grandchild. Jacob hooded his eyes and covered his mouth with his hand, so Hamor would not see his discomfort or surprise. He nodded as Hamor praised his daughter's beauty. Jacob had given no thought to a marriage for his daughter, although his wife had begun to speak of it. She was of age, to be sure. But Jacob was uneasy about this match, although he could not say why, and he felt his neck stiffen at Hamor's expectation that he would do as he was told. He searched his mind for a way to postpone a decision, a way to regain the upper hand. I will discuss this with my sons, he told the king, with more force than he meant. Hamor was stung. Your daughter is no virgin, Jacob, the king pressed. Yet here is a bride price fit for a virgin princess of Egypt, more than my own father gave for my wife. Not that your daughter is unworthy of this, and more. Name what you wish, and it is yours, for my son loves the girl, and I hear she is willing, too. And here Hamor smiled a bit too broadly for Jacob's taste. He did not like to hear his daughter spoken of so crudely, even though he could not quite conjure up the image of Dina's face. All he could recall clearly was the sight of her hair, unruly and wild, as she chased after Joseph. The memory came from long ago. I will wait for my sons, said Jacob, and he turned away from the king, as though the lord of Shechem were no more than a shepherd, and left it to his wives to welcome the king with drink and food. But Hamor saw no reason to stay, and headed back to his palace, trailing his gifts behind him. Jacob called for Leah, and spoke to her in the hardest words he had ever used with a wife. Your daughter is no longer a girl, he said. You were insolent to keep this from me. You have overreached before, but never to shame me. And now this. My mother was as surprised as her husband and pressed Jacob for news of her daughter. The prince of Shechem has claimed her. His father comes to pay the full bride price of a virgin. And so I assume that she was until she went within the walls of that dung heap of a city. Jacob was bitter. She is of Shechem now, I suppose, and of no use to me. Leah was furious. Go seek out your wife, my sister, she said. It was Rachel who took her there. Rachel is the one with eyes for the city, not me, husband. Ask your wife. And the smell of bile rose from my mother's words. I wonder if she thought of me at all then. if she suffered over whether I had consented or cried out, if her heart reached out to discover whether I wept or rejoiced. But her words spoke only of the loss of a daughter, gone to the city, where she would reside with foreign women, learn their ways, and forget her mother. My father called for Rachel next. "Husband," cried Rachel, smiling as she approached him, "I hear there are happy tidings." But Jacob did not smile. "I do not like the city or its king," he said, "but I like even less an untrustworthy daughter and a lying wife." "Say nothing you will regret," replied Rachel. "My sister sets you against me and against your only daughter, who is beloved of your mother at Mamre. This is a good match. The king says they are fond, does he not? Have you forgotten your own fire husband? Have you grown so old that you do not remember that longing?" Jacob's face betrayed nothing. He looked long at Rachel, and she returned his gaze. "Give them your blessing, husband," Rachel said. "Take the wagons laden with silver and linen, and give Hamor the welcome due a king. You are the master here. There is no need to wait." But Jacob stiffened at Rachel's insistence. "When my sons return from their travels, I will decide." Hamor could not recall ever being treated so badly. Even so, he was well disposed toward Jacob. "A good ally, I think," he told Shalem the next day, "but an enemy to avoid. He is a proud man," Hamor said. "He does not like to lose control of his family's fate. Odd that he should not yet know how children stop serving their parents once they are grown, even daughters." But Shalem pressed his father to return as soon as possible. "I love the girl," he said. Hamor grinned. "Fear not, the girl is yours. No father would want her back as she is now. Go back to your wife, and let me worry about the father." Another week passed, and my husband and I grew to love each other in subtler ways, with caresses and endearments. My feet did not touch ground. My face ached from smiling. And then I received a special wedding gift. Bilhah came to see me. My aunt appeared at the palace gate asking for Dina, wife of Shalem. She was taken first to Reinefer, who plied her with questions about Jacob's hesitancy over her husband's offer. The queen asked about Leah and Rachel as well, and told Bilhah not to leave the palace without gifts for her daughter-in-law's family. And then Reinefer herself brought my aunt to me. My hug lifted my little aunt off the ground, and I covered her dark face with a dozen kisses. "You are glowing," she said, when she stood back holding my hands in hers. "You are happy." She smiled. "It is wonderful that you should find such happiness. I will tell Leah, and she will be reconciled." "Is my mother angry?" I asked, bewildered. "Leah believes Rachel sold you into the hands of evil. She is like your father in her distrust of the city, and she is not pleased that you will make your bed within walls. Mostly, I think, she misses you. But I will tell her of the light in your eyes, of the smile on your lips, and of your womanly bearing now that you are a wife." "He is good to you, yes?" Bilhah asked, giving me the chance to praise my Shalem. I found myself bursting to tell someone the details of my happiness, and I spilled everything into Bilhah's willing ear. She clapped her hands to hear me speak like a bride. "Oh, to love and be loved like this," she sighed. Bilhah ate with me and peeked at Shalem. She agreed that he was beautiful, but refused to meet him. "I cannot speak to him before my husband does," she demurred, "but I have seen enough to bring back a good report of our daughter." In the morning, she embraced me and left with Reuben, who had brought her. She carried the word of my happiness into my father's tents, but her voice was drowned out by the shouts of my brothers, who called me harlot, and Jacob did nothing to stop their foul mouths. Simon and Levi had returned to our father after several days, defeated in a secret purpose. They had been in Ashkelon seeking trade not merely for the family's goats and sheep, wool and oil, but to speak with slave traders whose business could yield far greater wealth than any hard-earned harvest of the earth. Simon and Levi wanted wealth and the power it would bring them, but they had no hope of inheriting those from Jacob. It was clear that Reuben would get their father's birthright, and the blessing would go to Joseph. So they were determined to carve out their own glory however they could. But Levi and Simon discovered that the slavers wanted nothing but children. Business was bad. Too many traders had weakened the market, and now they were assured of a good price only for healthy youngsters. My brothers could get nothing at all in trade for the two old serving women they had from their wives' dowries. They returned home thwarted and bitter. When they heard that Hamor had offered my father a king's bride price for me, they raised their voices against the marriage, sensing that their own positions would be diminished by such an alliance. Jacob's house would be swallowed up in the dynasties of Shechem, and while Reuben might expect to become a prince, they and their sons would remain shepherds, poor cousins, nobodies. "We will be lower than Esau," they muttered to each other, and to the brothers over whom they still held sway, Zebulun, Issachar, and Naphtali of Leah's womb, and Zilpah's Gad and Asher. When Jacob called all his sons to his tent to consider Hamor's offer, Simon raised his fist and cried, "Revenge! My sister has been ravaged by an Egyptian dog!" Reuben spoke on behalf of Shalem. "Our sister did not cry out," he said, "nor does the prince cast her aside." Judah agreed. "The size of the bride price is a compliment to our sister, to our father, and to all the house of Jacob. We will become princes ourselves. We would be fools not to take the gifts that the gods give us. What kind of idiot mistakes a blessing for a curse?" But Levi ripped his clothing as though mourning my death, and Simon warned, "This is a trap for the sons of Jacob. If we permit this marriage, the fleshpots of the city will consume my sons and my brother's sons. This marriage displeases the God of our father," he said, challenging Jacob to disagree. Their voices grew loud, and my brothers glared at one another across the lamps, but Jacob did not let his own thoughts be known. "The uncircumcised dog rapes my sister every day," Simon thundered. "Am I to permit this desecration of our only sister, my own mother's daughter?" At this, Joseph pulled a skeptical face and half whispered to Reuben, "If my brother is so concerned about the shape of our brother-in-law's penis, let our father demand his foreskin for a bride price. Indeed, let all the men of Shechem become like us. Let them pile up their membranes as high as my father's tent pole, so that their sons and ours will piss the same and rut the same, and none will be able to tell us apart. And thus will the tribe of Jacob grow not merely in generations to come, but even tomorrow." Jacob seized upon Joseph's words, which had been spoken only in mockery of the brothers who had tortured him since infancy. But Jacob did not hear the edge in his son's words. He said, "Abram took up the knife for those of his household who were not of his covenant. If the men of Shechem agree to this, none could say that our daughter was injured. If the men of the city make such sacrifice to the God of my fathers, we shall be remembered as makers of souls, as gatherers of men. Like the stars in the heavens, as it was told to our father Abram, like the sands of the sea, was it foretold by my mother Rebekah. And now I will make it come to pass. I will do what Joseph says, for he has my heart." Jacob spoke with such passion that there was no use in further speech. Levi's face twisted in anger at Jacob's decision, but Simon placed a hand on his brother's arm and pulled him away into the night, far from the light of lamps and the ears of their brothers. When Hamor journeyed to Jacob's tent the second time, Shalem accompanied them. Determined not to return to the city without my father's blessing, he brought two donkeys laden with still more gifts. My beloved was confident as he left. But when he reached my father's tent, the king's party was again met with crossed arms, and not so much as a ladle of water was offered before the men began discussing terms. My father spoke first and without ceremony. "You come for our daughter," he said. "We will agree to the marriage, but I doubt if our terms will suit you, for they are severe." Hamor replied, his earlier warmth for the man blasted by the insulting lack of hospitality. "My son loves the girl," the king said. "He will do anything for her, and I will do what my son wishes. Name your terms, Jacob. Shechem will fulfill them so that your children and my children will bring forth new generations upon the land." But when Jacob named the price for his daughter, Hamor paled. "What form of barbarity is this?" he asked. "Who do you think you are, shepherd, to demand the blood of my son's manhood and mine, and that of my kinsmen and subjects? You are mad from too much sun, too many years in the wilderness. Do you want the girl back, such as she is? You must think very little of this daughter to make such sport of her future." But Shalem stepped forward and put his hand on his father's arm. "I agree to the demands," he said to Jacob's face. "Here and now, if you like. I will honor the custom of my wife's family, and I will order my slaves and their sons to follow me. I know my father speaks out of fear for me and in loyalty to his men who would suffer. But for me, there is no question. I hear and obey." Hamor would have argued against his son's offer, and Levi and Simon were poised to spit in his face. The air smelled like lightning, and daggers might have been drawn had Bilhah not appeared with water and wine. Women with bread and oil followed, and Jacob nodded for them to serve. They ate a few mouthfuls in silence. The terms were agreed to that evening. Jacob accepted 4 laden donkeys for a bride price. Shalem and Hamor would go under the knife in 3 days, as would the men of Shechem, noble and slave alike. All of the healthy men found within the walls of the city on that same morning would also accept the mark of Jacob upon them, and Hamor promised that every son born within the city from that time forth would be circumcised on the 8th day, as was the custom among the sons of Abram. Hamor also pledged that the God of Jacob would be worshipped in his temple, and the king went so far as to call him Elohim, the one God of the many gods. My father made me a handsome dowry, 18 sheep and 18 goats, all of my clothing and jewelry, my spindle and grindstone, 10 jars of new oil, and 6 great bolts of wool. Jacob agreed to permit marriages between his children and those of Shechem from that time forth. Hamor put his hand under Jacob's thigh, and Jacob touched the king as well, and my betrothal was sealed without a smile or satisfaction. That same night, Shalem slipped away from his father's tent and back into our bed with the news. "You are a married woman now, and not merely a ruined girl," he whispered, waking me before the first light of morning. I kissed him and pushed him away. "Well then, now that I am wed, and you may not put me aside, I may tell you that my head aches, and I cannot receive my lord at this moment," I said, gathering my robe about my shoulders, and feigning a great yawn, even as I slipped my hand between my husband's legs. "You know, my lord, that women only submit to the caresses of their husbands. They do not enjoy the rough use of their bodies." Shalem laughed and pulled me down on the bed, and we made love with great tenderness that morning. It was a reunion after what had been our longest parting since that day he found me in the market and led me to his bed, which we had made ours. We slept late into the day, and only after we had eaten did he tell me my father's demand. I grew cold, and my stomach turned. In my mind's eye, I saw my beloved in agonies of pain, saw the knife cut too deep, the wound fester, and Shalem dying in my arms. I burst into tears like a little child. Shalem made light of it all. "It is nothing," he said, "a flesh wound. And I hear that afterward, my pleasure of you will be even greater than it is now. So prepare yourself, woman. I will be upon you night and day. But I did not smile. I shivered with a cold that entered my bones and would not leave. Rainefer tried to reassure me, too. She was not displeased at the bargain her husband had struck. In Egypt, she said, they take boys for circumcision when their voices change. It is a merry enough time. They chase the boys and catch them, and afterward they are petted and fed on every sweet and savory thing they ask for. Rest assured, they all survive. We will have my guard do the deed, she said. Nahisi has dispatched many a foreskin. I can care for the pain, and you will help me, little midwife. She rattled on and on about how easy it would be, and then whispered with a knowing leer, Do you not find the male member more attractive without its hood? But I found nothing amusing about Shalem's test, and I did not return my mother-in-law's smile. The 3 days passed. I clung to my husband like a wild thing those nights, and tears ran down my face, even as I reached greater pleasure than before. My husband licked the water from my cheeks and ran his salty tongue the length of my body. I will tease you about this when our first son is born, he whispered, as I lay on his chest, still shaking with cold. The appointed hour arrived. Shalem left me at dawn. I stayed in bed, pretending to sleep, watching him wash and dress through closed eyes. He leaned down to kiss me, but I did not turn my face up to meet his lips. I lay there alone, counting my hatred. I hated my father for asking such a terrible price. I hated my husband and his father for agreeing to pay it. I hated my mother-in-law for smoothing the way. I hated myself most for being the cause of it all. I lay on the bed, huddled beneath blankets, shivering with anger and fear and unrecognized foreboding, until he was brought back to me. It was done in the king's antechamber. Shalem was first, and then his father, Hamor. Nahisi said that neither king nor prince cried out. Ashnan's little son followed and wailed, but the little one did not suffer long, since he had a full breast to console him. The men of the household, and the few poor souls who had not disappeared to the countryside outside the walls, were not so lucky. They felt the knife keenly, and many screamed as though they were murdered. Their cries pierced the air throughout the morning, but ceased by noon. It turned into an unmercifully hot day. There was no breeze or cloud, and even within the thick walls of the palace, the air was damp and heavy. The recovering men sweated through their clothing and soaked the beds where they slept. Hamor, who uttered no sound when he was cut, fainted in pain, and when he woke, put a knife between his teeth to keep from screaming. My Shalem suffered too, though not as badly. He was younger, and the salve seemed to ease him. But for him too, the only complete remedy was sleep. I dosed him with a sleeping draught, and whenever he roused, he was thick-headed and weary, slack-jawed and dazed. I bathed my beloved's face as he slept his drugged sleep, and washed his sweating back with the softest touch I could muster. I did my best not to weep, so my face would be fresh when he awoke. But as the day wore on, the tears came in spite of my efforts. By nightfall, I was exhausted, and I slept by my husband's side, swathed in blankets against the icy winds of my fears, even as Shalem slept naked in the heat. In the night, I woke once to feel Shalem caressing my cheek. When he saw my eyes open, he managed a wincing smile and said, Soon this will be nothing but a dream, and our embraces will be sweeter than ever. His eyes closed again, and I heard him snore for the first time. As I drifted into sleep, I thought how I would tease him about the noise he made in his sleep, like an old dog in the sun. To this day, I am not sure that Shalem spoke those words to me, or if it was a dream to comfort me. The rest I know to be true. First, there was the sound of a woman screaming. Something terrible must have happened to that poor soul, I thought, trying to turn away from the keening, shrieking, shrilling cry. Too dreadful for the real world, the noise of a nightmare. The wild, terrified scream came from a great distance, but its distress was so insistent and disturbing that I could not push it aside, and sought to awaken from my heavy sleep and escape the cries. They grew more and more frightening, until I realized that my eyes were open, and that the tormented soul I pitied was not dreamed or even distant. The screams were my own screams. The unearthly sound was coming from my twisted mouth. I was covered in blood. My arms were coated with the thick, warm blood that ran from Shalem's throat and coursed like a river down the bed and onto the floor. His blood coated my cheeks and stung my eyes and salted my lips. His blood soaked through the blankets and burned my breasts, streamed down my legs, coated my toes. I was drowning in my lover's blood. I was screaming loud enough to summon the dead, and yet no one seemed to hear. No guards burst through the door, no servants rushed in. It seemed that I was the last person alive in the world. I heard no footsteps and had no warning before strong arms seized me, prying me loose from my beloved. They carried me off the bed, trailing blood, screaming into the blackness of the night. It was Simon who lifted me, and Levi who sopped up my mouth, and the two of them trussed me hand and foot like a sacrificial goat, loaded me on the back of a donkey, and packed me off to my father's tent before I could alarm any poor soul still left alive in the doomed city. My brother's knives worked until the dawn revealed the abomination wrought by the sons of Jacob. They murdered every man they found alive. But I knew nothing of that. I knew only that I wanted to die. Nothing but death could stop my horror. Nothing but death could give me peace from the vision of Shalem slashed, bleeding, dead in his startled sleep. Had someone not loosened the gag when I vomited, I would have had my wish. All the way back up the hillside to the tents of Jacob, I screamed in silence. Oh, gods! Oh, heaven! Oh, mother! Why do I still live? Chapter 8. I was the first they knew of it. My own mother saw me and shrieked at the sight of my bloodied body. She fell to the ground, keening over her murdered child, and the tents emptied to learn the cause of Leah's grief. But Bilhah unbound me and helped me to stand, while Leah stared, first horrified, then relieved, and finally thunderstruck. She reached out her hands toward me, but my face stopped her. I turned, intending to walk back to Shechem, but my mother's lifted me off my feet, and I was too weak to resist. They stripped off my blankets and robes, black and stiff with the blood of Shalem. They washed me and anointed me with oil and brushed my hair. They put food to my lips, but I would not eat. They laid me down on a blanket, but I did not sleep. For the rest of that day, no one dared speak to me, and I had nothing to say. When night fell again, I listened to my brothers' return and heard the sound of their booty. Weeping women, wailing children, bleeding animals, carts creaking under the weight of stolen goods. Simon and Levi shouted hoarse orders. Jacob's voice was nowhere to be heard. I should have been defeated by grief. I should have been exhausted past seeing, but hatred had stiffened my spine. The journey up the mountain, bound like a sacrifice, had jolted me into a rage that fed upon itself as I lay on the blanket, rigid and alert. The sound of my brothers' voices lifted me off my bed, and I walked out to face them. Fire shot from my eyes. I might have burned them all to a cinder with a word, a breath, a glance. "Jacob!" I cried with the voice of a wounded animal. "Jacob!" I howled, summoning him by name, as though I were the father and he the wayward child. Jacob emerged from his tent, trembling. Later, he claimed that he had no knowledge of what had been done in his name. He blamed Simon and Levi and turned his back on them. But I saw full understanding in his clouded eyes as he stood before me. I saw his guilt before he had time to deny it. "Jacob, your sons have done murder," I said, in a voice I did not recognize as my own. "You have lied and connived, and your sons have murdered righteous men, striking them down in weakness of your own invention. You have despoiled the bodies of the dead and plundered their burying places, so their shadows will haunt you forever. You and your sons have raised up a generation of widows and orphans who will never forgive you." "Jacob," I said in a voice that echoed like thunder. "Jacob," I hissed in the voice of the serpent who sheds life and still lives. "Jacob," I howled, and the moon vanished. "Jacob shall never know peace again. He will lose what he treasures and repudiate those he should embrace. He will never again find rest, and his prayers will not find the favor of his father's God." "Jacob knows my words are true. Look at me, for I wear the blood of the righteous men of Shechem. Their blood stains your hands and your head, and you will never be clean again. You are unclean, and you are cursed," I said, spitting into the face of the man who had been my father. Then I turned my back upon him, and he was dead to me. I cursed them all. With the smell of my husband's blood still in my nostrils, I named them each and called forth the power of every god and every goddess, every demon and every torment, to destroy and devour them. The sons of my mother Leah, and the son of my mother Rachel, and the sons of my mother Zilpah, and the son of my mother Bilhah. The blood of Shechem was embedded beneath my fingernails, and there was no pity in my heart for any of them. "The sons of Jacob are vipers," I said to my cowering brothers. "They are putrid as the worms that feed on carrion. The sons of Jacob will each suffer in his turn, and turn the suffering upon their father." The silence was absolute and solid as a wall when I turned away from them. Barefoot, wearing nothing but a shift, I walked away from my brothers and my father and everything that had been home. I walked away from love as well, never again to see my reflection in my mother's eyes. But I could not live among them. I walked into a moonless night, bloodying my feet and battering my knees, on the path to the valley, but never stopped until I arrived at the gates of Shechem. I kept a vision before me. I would bury my husband and be buried with him. I would find his body and wrap him in linen, take the knife that had stolen his life and open my wrists with it, so we could sleep together in the dust. We would pass eternity in the quiet, sad, gray world of the dead, eating dust, looking through eyes made of dust upon the false world of men. I had no other thought. I was alone and empty. I was a grave looking to be filled with the peace of death. I walked until I found myself before the great gate of Shechem, on my knees, unable to move. If Reuben had found me and carried me back, my life would have ended. I might have walked and wept for many years more, half mad, finishing my days in the doorway of a lesser brother's third wife, but my life would have been finished. If Reuben had found me, Simon and Levi would surely have killed my baby, leaving it out in the night for the jackals to tear apart. They might have sold me into slavery along with Joseph, ripping my tongue out first to stop me from cursing their eyes, skin, bones, scrotums. I would never be appeased by their pain and suffering, no matter how ghastly. Nor would I have been mollified when Jacob cowered and took a new name, Israel, so that people would not remember him as the butcher of Shechem. He fled from the name Jacob, which became another word for liar, so that "you serve the God of Jacob" was one of the worst insults one man could hurl at another in that land for many generations. Had I been there to see it, I might have smiled when his gift with animals deserted him, and even his dogs ran from his side. He deserved no less than the agony of learning that Joseph had been torn by wild beasts. Had Reuben found me at the gates of Shechem, I would have been there to give Rachel the burial she deserved. Rachel died on the highway, where Jacob had gone to flee the wrath of the valley, which set out to avenge the destruction of Hamor and the peace of Shechem. Rachel perished in agony, giving birth to Jacob's last son. Son of Woe, she named the little boy, who cost her a river of black blood. But the name Rachel chose for her son was too much of an accusation, so Jacob defied the wish of his dying wife and pretended that Ben-Oni was Benjamin. Jacob's fear chased him away from Rachel's poor, drained body, which he buried hastily and without ceremony at the side of the road, with nothing but a few pebbles to remember the great love of his life. Perhaps I would have stayed there at Rachel's grave with Inna, who planted herself in that spot and gathered beautiful stones to make an altar to the memory of her only daughter. Inna taught the women of the valley to speak the name of Rachel and tie red cords around her pillar, promising that in return their wombs would bear only living fruit and ensuring that my aunt's name would always live in the mouths of women. If Reuben had found me, I would have watched my curse wrap itself around his neck, unleashing a lifetime of unspent passion and unspoken declarations of love for Bilhah and of hers for him. When that dam broke, they went breathlessly into each other's arms, embracing in the fields, under the stars, and even inside Bilhah's own tent. They were the truest lovers, the very image of the Queen of the Sea and her lord brother, made for each other, yet doomed for it. When Jacob came upon them, he disinherited the most deserving of his sons and sent him to a distant pasture where he could not protect Joseph. Jacob struck Bilhah across the face, breaking her teeth. After that, she began to disappear. The sweet one, the little mother, became smaller and thinner, more silent, more watchful. She did not cook anymore, but only spun, and her string was finer than any woman had ever spun, as fine as a spider's web. Then one day, she was gone. Her clothes lay upon her blanket, and her few rings were found where her hands might have lain. No footprints led into the distance. She vanished, and Jacob never spoke her name again. Zilpah died of fever the night that Jacob smashed the last of Rachel's household gods under a sacred tree. He had come across the little frog goddess, the one that had unlocked the wombs of generations of women, and he took an axe to the ancient idol. He urinated on the crushed stone, cursing it as the cause of all his misfortune. Seeing this, Zilpah ripped at her hair and screamed into the sky. She begged for death and spit upon the memory of the mother who left her. She lay on the ground and put handfuls of dirt into her mouth. 3 men were needed to tie her down to keep her from doing herself harm. It was an awful death, and as they prepared her for the grave, her body broke into pieces like a brittle old clay lamp. I am glad I did not see that. I am grateful I was not there as Leah lost the use of her hands and then her arms, nor to see her on the morning she awoke in her own filth, unable to stand. She would have begged me, as she begged her unfeeling daughters-in-law, to give her poison, and I would have done it. I would have taken pity and cooked the deadly drink and killed her and buried her. Better that than to die mortified. Had Reuben carried me back to the tents of the men who had turned me into the instrument of Shalem's death, I would have done murder in my heart every day. I would have tasted bile and bitterness in my dreams. I would have been a blot upon the earth. But the gods had other plans for me. Reuben came too late. The sun shone above the walls of the city when he arrived at the eastern gate, and by then, other arms had carried me away. Part 3. Egypt. Chapter 1. I lay senseless in the arms of Nahisi, Ranefer's steward and guard. He carried me to the palace, which swarmed with flies drawn to the blood of fathers and sons. My demon brothers had lifted their knives even against Ashnan's baby, and his poor mother bled to death defending him, her arm severed trying to block the axe's blade. Of all the men in that house, only Nahisi survived. When the screams began, he ran to the king's chambers in time to protect Ranefer against Levi and one of his men. The queen had lifted a knife against Levi when Nahisi arrived. He wounded my brother in the thigh and killed his henchman outright. He wrested the blade from the queen to keep her from burying it in her own heart. Nahisi brought me to Ranefer, who sat in the dirt of the courtyard, her head against the wall, dust in her hair, fingernails caked with blood. It was years before I understood why she did not leave me to die, why the murder of her loved ones did not fill her with rage against me, who caused it all. But Ranefer blamed only herself for the death of her husband and son, because she had wished for our marriage and made sacrifices to ensure our union. She had sent Shalem to seek me in the market and arranged for us to fall into each other's arms unhindered. She took the guilt upon herself and never put it aside. The other reason for Ranefer's compassion toward me was even stronger than remorse. She had hope of a grandchild, someone to build her tomb and redeem the waste of her life, someone to live for. Which is why, in the moments before she fled Canaan, Ranefer roused herself and sent Nahisi out into the wailing town to seek me. Her servant obeyed in silence, but with dread. He knew the queen better than anyone, better than her serving women, better than her husband, surely. Nahisi had come to Shechem with Ranefer when she first arrived, a frightened young bride. And when he found me, he wondered whether he should add to his mistress's grief by carrying still more sorrow into her presence. I lay in his arms like a corpse, and when I did stir, it was to scream and scratch at my throat until I drew blood. They had to tie my hands and bind my mouth so that we could slip out of the city undetected in the dark of that night. Ranefer and Nahisi unearthed jars filled with gold and silver and stole away, with me, to the port of Joppa, where they hired a Minoan boat for the journey to Egypt. During the journey, there was a terrible storm that tore the sails and nearly overturned the ship. The sailors, who heard me screaming and sobbing, thought I was possessed by a demon who roiled the waters against them. Only Nahisi's sword kept them from laying hands on me and tossing me into the waves. I knew none of this as I lay in the darkness, swaddled, sweating, trying to follow my husband. Perhaps I was too young to die of grief. Or maybe I was too well cared for to perish in sorrow. Ranefer never left me. She kept my lips moist and spoke to me in the soothing, all-forgiving tone that mothers take with fretful babies. She found cause to hope. A new moon arrived while I lay in my own darkness, and no blood stained the blankets beneath my legs. My belly was soft, and my breasts burned, and my breath smelled of barley. After a few days, my sleep became less fevered. I gulped at the broth that Ranefer fed me and squeezed her fingers in mute gratitude. On the day of our landing, my mother-in-law came to me, placed her fingers firmly on my lips, and spoke with an urgency that had nothing to do with my health. "We return to the land of my mother and father," she said. "Hear what I say and obey. I will call you daughter in front of my brother and his wife," she said. "I will tell them that you served in my household and that my son took you, a virgin, with my consent. I will say that you helped me to escape from the barbarians. You will become my daughter-in-law, and I will be your mistress. You will bear your son on my knees, and he will be a prince of Egypt." Her eyes found mine and demanded understanding. She was kind, and I loved her, and yet something seemed wrong. I could not name my fear as she spoke. Later, I realized that my new mother had not named her son, my husband, saying nothing of his murder, nor of my brothers and their deception. We never wept or mourned over Shalem, nor did she tell me where my beloved was buried. The horror was to remain unspoken, my grief sealed behind my lips. We never again spoke of our shared history, and I was bound to the emptiness of the story she told. When I set foot in Egypt, I was pregnant and widowed. I wore the white linen of an Egyptian, and although I was no longer a maiden, I went with uncovered head like the other women of the land. I carried a small basket for Ranefer, but I brought nothing of my own. I had not so much as a scrap of wool woven by my own mothers, nor even the consolation of memory. There were many wonders to see on the journey to the great city of the south, which was home to Ranefer's brother. We passed cities and pyramids, birds and hunters, palms and flowers, sandy wastes and cliffs, but I saw nothing of these. My eyes stayed mostly upon the river itself, and I stared into the water, trailing a hand into the darkness, which was by turn brown, green, black, gray, and once, as we passed a tannery, the color of blood. That night, I woke clutching my neck, drowning in blood, screaming for Shalem, for help, for my mother, in a nightmare that would visit me again and again. First, I felt the weight of Shalem against my back, a wonderful heaviness that comforted me completely. But then came an unnatural heat onto my chest and hands, and then I discovered my mouth was full of Shalem's blood, my nose clogged with the dusty smell of life ebbing out of him. My eyes were thick with blood, and I struggled to open them. I screamed without drawing breath, though I heard no sound. Still, I kept screaming, in hope that my heart and stomach would rise out of me in the scream and I could die too. On the fourth night of this dream, just as the blood began to swallow me and my mouth opened to seek death, I was shocked to my senses by searing pain that left me gasping. I sat up to find Nahisi above me, the flat edge of his broad sword laid against the soles of my feet where he had struck me. "No more of this," he hissed. "Ranefer cannot bear it." He left me, my hair on end, struggling to catch my breath. And from that night, I woke myself as soon as I felt warmth oozing onto my breasts. Panting and sweating, I lay on my back and tried not to fall asleep again. I came to dread the sunset the way some men dread death. By day, the sun bleached away my fears. In the morning, before the heat poured down, Ranefer sat with me and Nahisi and recounted cheerful stories from her childhood. We saw a duck, and she recalled hunting expeditions with her father and brothers, the eldest of whom was to be our refuge. As a little girl, she had been entrusted with the throwing sticks, handing them to the hunters, anticipating their needs. When we passed a great house, Ranefer described her father's home in Memphis, and the many gardens and pools in its great courtyard. Her father had been a scribe for the priests of Re, and life had been pleasant for his family. Ranefer recalled every servant and slave who had waited upon her as a child. She spoke of her own mother, Nebitani, whom she remembered as lovely, but distant, always at her coal pots, happiest when the servants poured pot after pot of scented water over her back in her beautiful bath. But Nebitani died in childbirth when Ranefer still wore the forelock of a little girl. My mother-in-law retraced her days with charming tales and stories from her infancy until the very week that she left Egypt to be married. The preparations were elaborate, and a great dowry was assembled. Ranefer could recall the very quantities of linen in her chests, the jewels on her fingers and neck, the bargeman who carried her up to the sea. I leaned forward, hoping to learn some detail about life in Shechem, to hear the story of Shalem's birth, or a tale from his boyhood. But she stopped just at the point she arrived in her husband's palace. A blank stare replaced her gaiety. She said nothing of Canaan, nor of her husband, nor of the baby she bore him. She did not speak the name of Hamor even once, and it was as though Shalem had never been born, nor loved me, nor bled to death in my arms. Rhaenefer's silence throbbed with pain, but when I reached out to touch her hand, she resumed a cheerful smile and turned away to chatter about the beauty of palm trees or her brother's great position as chief scribe and overseer to the priests of Re. I returned my gaze to the water and kept my eyes there until we arrived at Thebes. The great city was dazzling in the setting sun. To the west, purple cliffs held a green valley dotted with brightly painted temples hung with pennants of green and gold. On the east bank, there were great houses as well as temples and whitewashed warrens of smaller buildings, all glowing shades of rose and gold as the sun began its retreat behind the western bluffs. I saw white tents on the rooftops and wondered if a separate race of people lived above the city dwellers. The streets that led away from the river were noisy and dusty, and we moved through them quickly, seeking our destination before nightfall. The scent of lotus grew stronger as the light faded. Nahisi asked a passerby if he knew the way to the home of the scribe, Noctre. The man pointed toward a large building that sat beside one of the grand temples of the eastern bank. A naked little girl opened the large, burnished door and blinked at the three strangers before her. Rhaenefer demanded an audience with Noctre, her brother, but the child only stared. She saw an Egyptian lady who wore a dusty robe and no makeup or jewelry, a large black guard with a dagger at his waist but no shoes on his feet, and a foreigner in an ill-fitting dress who kept her head so low she might be hiding a hare lip. When the servant did not budge after Rhaenefer repeated her request, Nahisi pushed the door open and walked through the vestibule into a great hall. The master of the house was concluding the business of the day, scrolls in his lap and assistants at his feet. He stared at Nahisi, startled and uncomprehending. But when he saw Rhaenefer, Noctre leaped to his feet, scattering papers as he rushed to embrace her. As his arms encircled her, Rhaenefer began to weep. Not tears of relief and happiness from a woman glad to be reunited with her family, but the raw sobs of a mother whose child had been murdered in his bed. Rhaenefer howled in her bewildered brother's arms. She dropped to her knees and keened, giving voice to a broken heart. The terrible sound brought all of Noctre's household into the room, cooks and gardeners, bakers and children, and the lady of the house. Noctre gathered his sister up and put her on his own chair, where she was fanned and given water. All eyes were fixed on Rhaenefer, who took her brother's hands in hers and told him the bare details of her tale as she had rehearsed it to me. She said that her home had been overrun by barbarians, her possessions stolen, her family butchered, her whole life pillaged. She spoke of her escape and the storm at sea. When Noctre asked about her husband, she replied, "Dead, and my son," and collapsed in tears once more. At this, the women of the house commenced a high-pitched wail of mourning that crept up the flesh of my neck like a curse.